tonight, Trish H. from Solvang.
Hi, everybody. I'm Trish, and I'm an alcoholic. Hi, Patricia, actually. Just kidding. Somebody told me not to do that. I'll try to avoid peas. Sorry, let me get all organized. Okay, so 45 minutes. Got it? Okay. All right. Whew. Glad to see people I know in the audience. Makes it a little easier, but also kind of not. Thank you for asking me to come and tell my story. It's an honor and a privilege. All right, I'm just going to get started, and then like maybe my brain and my body will relax. So my sobriety date is September 20th, 1993. So September 20th, I'll celebrate 22 years of sobriety. I got sober when I was 20, and Billy here got to see that disaster for the first 5 years of my sobriety. I really grew up in this program, and I continue to do so. I want to welcome the newcomers here. I'd like to especially welcome the newcomer moms that are here and here with their kids. You know, you're welcome here. Please come no matter what. Larry, right? Where are you? Where'd he go? Anyways, Larry, thank you for your 10-minute. Basically, I was like listening to you going, okay, well, now I have to come up with new material because you said everything that I was going to say in the beginning. But really, truly, I grew up, you know, exactly the same. I was saying my pitch in the earlier today while I was going to the bathroom at work, going, okay, I'm going to say this, I'm going to say that. And basically, all I've ever known is alcoholism. You know, grew up in an alcoholic family. My mom's an alcoholic. My grandfather was an alcoholic. My great-grandfather was an alcoholic. Either you're very sick with Al-Anonism or you're sick with alcoholism in my family. Nobody gets out alive, you know, one or the other. And everybody's just as crazy. I mean, Al-Anons are just as crazy as the alcoholics, and I can attest to that because I am. I'm a sick Al-Anon, too. In fact, when I was 5 years sober, my mom relapsed after 10 years, and Al-Anon saved my life. Al-Anon actually, I was able to stay sober because of Al-Anon, as weird as that sounds. Somebody once told me that Al-Anon is graduate school for alcoholics, that it kicks your ass. I mean, it is a hard program. It's hard. I mean, first of all, it's like they show up late, you know, it's just, I was raised, Jason and I were just talking, and there's several other people here in this meeting that were raised sort of Santa Barbara style AA, and that's where I got sober. I got sober in Santa Barbara, and I have a lineage, I have the same sponsor for 17 years. She still lives in Santa Barbara. I still talk to her. She has seen me through thick thin. She taught me about unconditional love, and I can tell her anything, and that's important because our secrets make us sick, and they alienate us, and when I feel lonely and alienated and I'm shaming myself, that's when I need to get out, and I'll do it with sugar, I'll do it with relationships, and finally I'll do it with alcohol, and luckily, you know, for 21 plus years, I haven't had to go the alcohol route. Many people who know me know that I am addicted to chocolate, and I am just going to keep doing that until the wheels fall off. It's terrible. All right, so let me back up. So my lineage for, you know, Alcoholics Anonymous is that my sponsor is 30 plus years sober, and then her sponsor is 40 plus years sober. Linda Heth is my sponsor. Mary McNally is her sponsor. And I got, my first sponsor was Teresa Cordero. I've been trained. When I got here, you get, and this is, when I sponsor someone, I just tell them, this is what I did. If you want what I have, do what I do. If you don't, it's what it tells us in the big book. If they don't want what you have, you go on to the next person who does. Working with others helps me. Flowers for me? I'm just kidding. There's somebody in the back. That's okay. Come on in. You're welcome. Who ordered me flowers? That's so kind. Whoopsies. You guys are weirdos. Bringing in this sweet lady while I'm... Anyways. But it's only once a month, correct?
Oh, okay. Well, that kind of makes sense. Yeah. That kind of makes sense. Because I was like, well, not so, okay.
Very pretty. Did you put that together?
I sure did.
She put this together. Very nice.
Thank you. All right. You guys have a good night.
Thank you, you too. Okay. So being raised in an alcoholic family, I just roll with the punches. So, I mean, I can, like, think on my feet. That poor lady, she's probably so embarrassed. But she did a good job. I actually had a flower stand when I was about 10 years sober. I decided it was a good idea to open a flower stand, and I had never been formally trained. I had some really great ideas. Billy, do you remember that? Awesome Blossom? Yeah. Oh, my poor parents. Okay. So, all right. So where am I with my sponsors? Oh, okay. So I got sober. The first time I ever went to a meeting, I heard people talking, and it was like, okay, I'm home. I am not different. These people are talking my language. They did things that I would not want to admit. They drank like I did. And from the moment I came into a meeting, I've been sober ever since, and this is my home. Whenever I speak, I talk about, for me, I had to fall in love with Alcoholics Anonymous, and I still am. You know, I think for me and my type of alcoholic, it has to come before anything, and it continues to do so. I have two kids, and as I mentioned, my mom's an alcoholic, and I grew up, it was not fun. It was very dysfunctional. My brother and I were neglected. I used to steal to eat. Sometimes I didn't know where my mom was. I would have to call her at the bar to beg her to come home. In the morning, my brother and I would have to go check if she was alive. She'd be on the bed, and we didn't know if she was alive or dead. So that's what I saw growing up. That was the parenting that I had. Oops. So being sober as a mom, I take it so, so seriously, and that's why even after this amount of sobriety, I still go to 3 meetings a week, because I protect my sobriety with everything that I have, because I never want my kids to grow up the way I did. And I know it doesn't matter how much I want that. It doesn't matter how much I know that I don't want that. The disease is insidious, and if I don't go to meetings and if I don't work the program, it'll take me out, and it won't matter how much I love my kids. It's that, and I see it time and time again. You know, I come to meetings, and I watch moms who love their kids go out, and they die, and they leave their kids. And so I keep coming back, because I'm not immune to that. I'm one drink away from, you know, having my kids be abandoned. I stay super humble here. I don't think I have it, you know, in the bag. I know that I have to keep coming back. I know that I have to keep carrying the message. Okay, so let me tell you that I drank. Let's get there. Okay, so I started drinking when I was 13, and I don't remember. I grew up in Scotland for 4 years, and in a small village, and from the gate, I felt very different. First of all, we were Americans in this small Scottish village. My mom was the town drunk. We were the only Catholics and a Protestant. I mean, it's like just down the list of things that made me different, you know, just like it was, I immediately felt different, and there were significant differences. So when I first took my first drink, like many of you, I felt it. It felt great. It made my body relax. It started to shut my head off. Up until then, I had absolutely no, basically just survived. I had, you know, at 13, I didn't really know what I was doing. I didn't care. I just bounced around. I used attention from boys to make me feel better. I had a lot of potential in school, but, you know, I can do 50-yard dashes, but I can't run a marathon. You know, you give me one thing and I'll do it, but I won't finish, you know. Like in college, I would go all the way to the end of the semester and then not show up for the final because there was a party. Or, you know, it's just the only thing I've ever done perfectly in my life is this. It's the only thing that I've done 100%. So anyways, that first drink. And I finally had something I wanted to do. I wanted to be a bar drinker once I had my first drink. It was like, okay, that's what I want to aspire to be. I just want to do this. And the craziness of that is that I used to have to call my mom at the bar and beg her to come home. I mean, that's how crazy this disease is. I hated it. I said I'd never be like my mom. And the minute I took the drink, I didn't care. I just wanted to do it. So I didn't have the opportunity to drink from then on. It was very sporadic. I did most of my drinking, and I was a blackout drinker in high school. I was a member of the SAD, Students Against Drunk Driving, and I was a chameleon, like many of us are. You never, ever would think that I would drink the way that I did. But I am really good at hiding. It's actually one of the things that I've had to work on in my sobriety is letting people really know who I am. I mean, I try to make other moms feel better by going, okay, I might look like I have it all together, but if you were to see my house, you'd be like, what is wrong with that lady? There's dishes everywhere, laundry everywhere. But, you know, being real is really, it's important to be real. But I don't like to do that. I like to hide behind a facade. So in high school, I drank and blacked out. I barely graduated. I hated high school. I went to a private Catholic high school, and kids there drove Ferraris and Beamers. And I grew up in like a normal house, like, you know, suburbia, whatever. But my first car was a 1973 orange Toyota Corolla that was passed down from my aunt. And I'm rolling into my high school. Oh, first of all, the first week I had it, I crashed and I leveled a truck. And the back end, the trunk was like crushed. And my parents, to sort of punish me, didn't get it fixed. And so I had it like jimmied with a bungee cord. So every time I would drive into my high school, past all these rich kids, okay, I would go over the speed bump, and the trunk would go, co-conk, co-conk. And they would, like, be looking at me. And I'm like, okay, well, maybe if I, like, blast Led Zeppelin, they'll still think I'm cool, you know. I mean, it was, like, all about image. And how could I possibly compete with kids with all that money, you know? But you know what I've learned here is that it doesn't matter about money. It doesn't matter what you have. I know plenty of those rich kids had really sad families, you know. In fact, one of the richest kids in the class, their mom committed suicide. So, I mean, it really doesn't matter the outsides. It's the insides. So I came to Santa Barbara to college following a boy because I really actually knew nothing. I had no self-esteem. I had a learning disability that I didn't know about, but I heard about I could go to Santa Barbara City College and live in the dorms, and that was great for me because I didn't have the courage to take the SATs. I thought, you know, everybody's talking about college, and I just, again, feel left out. I don't understand. I don't want to ask questions because I don't want to look stupid. People were going to Chico, and I was like, is that short for Chicago? I mean, I really had no clue. I guess he was my boyfriend, but not really. he was my boy. So I'm going to totally jump around, you guys. So since I've been in relationships, I've had challenges. Let's just call them challenges. I've had things that have kept me from really having good relationships. And the craziest thing, and the hope that I share with you, is that it doesn't matter how long you've been sober, the steps will help, and the program will help, and the honesty will really change anything, as long as you're willing. I mean, I have had character defects come and go over the last 20 plus years, and I would feel like I'm never going to change. Never, ever am I not going to be like this. And I would feel so much despair. But I just kept plugging away at it. I keep plugging away at it, and I keep praying to be different. And I've had this, like, crazy character defect removed in the last 6 months. And it's just because I was finally willing to surrender. And I was finally willing to do what my sponsor had showed me. And I was finally willing to be like the ladies that I see in my life, you know, and take their advice. And so it sometimes feels like, God, I have all this sobriety. What the hell? Why am I still like this? But it's sometimes quickly, sometimes slowly. I mean, I had things removed right away, but some things just kept hanging on. But it's just about, for me, the willingness. And truly, I see miracles happen all the time. People, myself, you know, is this ever going to change? And I just keep plugging away. I keep praying. I keep trying to be different. And I'm really stoked. I have like a really great relationship right now, and I have never had a great relationship. I'm like the a-hole magnet, but that's because of me. I admit that now that I had to fix things in me. I had to look at myself and change things in myself and not blame those other people, because things will never change if I'm blaming other people. And that's how I came in here. I blamed everybody for how I felt. I basically felt like I was schizophrenic when I came in here, because I had started hearing voices when I wasn't drinking. And it was like, you know when that insanity of, okay, I'm not going to drink today. I'm not going to drink in this situation. So my last drink looked something like this. I told you I'm a chameleon. I lived with this. I would always lie to people. Depended on who. I was either a partier or I didn't drink at all. And frankly, I would have periods of not drinking, 6 months, whatever. My problem is that I could never stop drinking. That was the problem. So I was living with this gal, and she didn't think I drank. And she worked at a restaurant with some of the rugby players that I partied with. And if you know how rugby players party, they it's crazy. And I kept right up with them. You know, I prided myself on that. That's kind of sad. So she was going to have a brunch over at our house. And she was going to have all these guys come over to the party. And I was like, okay, there's these two lives, this one me and then this other me, and they're going to have to be in the same room, and I'm going to have to juggle these lies. And I was like, okay, so I had at that point, when I took a drink, I had no idea what was going to happen. Like, and I actually like that. That's kind of cool to me. You know, like, I love the freedom of being able to take a drink and having no idea what was going to happen. It was like, I liked it. The oblivion, right? We drink for oblivion, and it's great. It's like a relief. It's like, okay, good. I'm gonna drink, and I'm gonna keep checking to make sure. Like, am I there yet? Am I there yet? And if I'm not, I'm gonna just keep drinking until I'm there, until I actually don't know that I'm there anymore. So I sat on my bed that day, and I was like, I cannot drink today, because I will do totally inappropriate things with these guys at the party, and then my roommate will see through this facade that I have going. And I just knew it was going to be a disaster. So I sat on my bed, and I, okay, you cannot drink today. And I had said that so many times before. But you know, you get to the party or you get to the bar or whatever, 5 minutes goes by, you can't remember why you said you weren't going to drink. I mean, who can remember? It's so nice in here, and it's gonna just a few, right? It's never just a few. I think Larry was talking, who drinks one drink? Who does that? It's irritating. Have you ever been to dinner with somebody and they're nursing a glass of wine? It's like, oh God, you're killing me. stop doing that, just drink it. So I get out there, the party is starting, I'm sitting there next to one of my guy friends, and I don't know how long it's been, but I'm coming out of my skin. I am so uncomfortable. You know that feeling when you can't drink and you want to drink so bad, and it's like you're like holding on for dear life, and the fear that I felt and the anguish that I felt, it was like, that's why I drank, to stop all that stuff. But it was all coming up, and I was like, I can't do this. And so I get up to go to the kitchen, and I was like, so is any, and they hadn't even started serving the alcohol. I mean, we were like, what, 10 minutes into the party? Come on. So I go in there, and I make myself a mimosa, and I come out, and I sit down, and I took some of the mimosa, and a voice, really, really loud, and I believe it was my higher power, said you weren't going to drink today. And I had heard that before. I'd had that, like, you know, didn't you say you weren't going to drink today? But this time I heard it, and I felt it, and it really scared me. I really got at that very moment how powerless I was over it, that I have no power over alcohol. It doesn't matter if I say I'm not going to, if I swear I'm not going to, if I know I'm going to humiliate myself in front of people, if I'm going to do something terrible, it doesn't matter. And so that was it. It was weird. I put the drink down, and then I happened to be working at a restaurant where another girl was sober, and talk about attraction. All these young kids would come in, kids, like they were 20. Now I think everybody that's 20 is a kid, because I'm 40 something. So these 20-year-olds were coming in, and there were some cute guys there, right? Cute young guys. And so I was like, oh yeah, I'll go to some meetings, sure. And that's how I came into AA, chasing a boy, just like how I came to college, just chasing a boy. It doesn't matter how you get here, in my opinion. And so I started going to meetings, and I, just like I told you, I got right in. I started commitments. What was required of me was to call my sponsor every day at a time, and my time was 5:45. Okay, so up until then, I could manipulate anybody. It's like a gift, okay? And I could lie my way out of things. I could pass classes in college by just telling a story. I'm like the master manipulator, right? And this lady scared the bejesus out of me. I was so afraid of her. And so this people-pleasing part of me actually came in really handy, because I wanted her to like me so much. And she was like, it's the edges have been rounded off over the years of this woman, but she was really scary. If you know Teresa C., you know what I mean. She's super scary. And I wanted to do everything that she said. So 5:40, I'd be waiting by the phone, and I'd be like counting down the time, and I'd call her right at 5:45. And what that taught me was commitment. And all these little things that we tell you to do, and all these little things that we're taught, it's like, at the time, you don't really know, or I didn't really know why. It was like, I just wanted to make somebody happy. But after that, you know, I started being able to call her and tell her stuff and let her in a little bit, and it became less scary. So, and I also had to have, can you give me like a 10-minute heads up? Okay, thanks. So I got commitments, and I was a greeter, and then what else did I do? I just did everything. Like Larry said, I did everything anybody asked me to do. I shook hands. I gave out my number. Let's see. How was I, like 10 years sober when I chaired the convention? So that's kind of a funny story. For some reason, the good people of AA Fellowship thought that it was a good idea for me to chair a convention, and bless their hearts, I still was very, very sick and very, very egotistical. And so I took our, and I really like things to look nice and be really pretty. So I just took over that convention committee, and I did everything I wanted to do. I think I blew our budget on food and decorations and ended putting us in a hole of like at least a few $1,000, maybe even 5 to 10. And seriously, I did this. And that was one of the many humiliating things that I did in my early sobriety. But you know what? I knew people were talking about me. I knew people were gossiping about me. But I just kept coming to meetings. I just held my head up, and I kept coming to meetings because that's what my sponsor told me. She's just like, you just go. And it was really embarrassing. But you know what it taught me? Well, I'm still terrible with money, but honestly, it was so long ago, I don't really know what it taught me, but I like to share it because it just, I haven't been perfect, you know? It's like I've grown up here, and really, like, and then Billy and Robin, who will be your speaker in a little while, all those people just still loved me, you know? It's like I screw up, and they still love me, and they still, you know, we believe in you, and it's okay, And I learned you come to meetings even if your ass is falling off, even if you're red-faced, even if you're embarrassed, even if you're humiliated. I mean, oh my God, it's so embarrassing. So I used to sit in the front pew of this the Friday night meeting in Santa Barbara, and anytime I broke up with a guy, I'd be at the front pew just crying. I mean, just like so obnoxious, just, you know, like I've learned how to be a woman of grace and dignity here. You know, I've grown up. I heard somebody say that you're still a newcomer if you're anywhere like 10 years and below, so looks like I might be in the old-timer range here, maybe a grown-up, so that's good. All right, what other fun stuff? So I met my ex-husband in AA and did the whole, you know, meet your husband in AA, like, why does anybody think that's, no, well, you're a good idea. You and your wife, that's good. No, but it was not, I will admit, I self-willed that thing to even my family tells me now, they're like, you are going to get married come hell or high water. I was like, yes, I was. But, you know, I have two beautiful kids from that marriage, and, you know, I had to go through that divorce in AA, and I knew people were talking about me. And I knew people didn't know the whole story. And I knew people thought this, that, and the other thing. And I just, my sponsor said, you keep your mouth shut. You don't explain to anybody. You don't have to. And then I've just recently had this other old-timer lady that I've been kind of asking some advice for. She told me today in a text, ain't nobody's business but you and God. And I mean, really, like, that's what it's all about. In the end, be true to yourself, you know, and this. Right here. So this is how I know how to live, this thing right here. And if I ever have any questions, I go here. If my sponsees ever have any questions, I go here. If I don't know, I try really hard not to give advice because, frankly, I haven't lived my life all that great. I mean, I've survived, but I have made a lot of mistakes. But if I go back to this, you know, it brings me back to the simplicity. If you go to page 83 and 84, you know, that's how you wake up and that's how you go to bed. If you have any questions, if things are getting hairy in your life and you're kind of like, I'm spun out, you just go back to the book. You read page 83 and 84. If you have sex troubles, strange enough, page 68 and 69, go there. Okay? I always thought that was so funny. It is funny. It's naughty, right? That suits me fine. I love it. So my home group is a Thursday night book study, women's book study. And I've gone to a women's meeting my whole sobriety because that women, you stick with the women, and men, you stick with the men. Because that is who's going to pull you through all the hard stuff, you know? I mean, I learned a lot in my marriage, but I'm learning even more, learning how to be a good friend, you know? And they teach me how to be a good mom, and they teach me how to be women of grace and dignity. So we read out of the big book, and then we also read out of the 12 and 12, and then I go to a As Bill Sees It meeting on Tuesday nights. I feel that it's really important to stay in the literature. I feel it's really important to share the history of AA, the etiquette of AA, how our program started, talk about Dr. Bob and Bill W. and how it all started, because truly that was miraculous. It was miraculous that Bill was in the hotel, right? He is having a shitty day, okay? I mean, any one of us would have gone into that bar. Any one of us. You know, you're feeling terrible, down on your luck. Oh, I'm sorry, I'm swearing. Does he have his headphones? Okay, good. All right. Okay. All right. So he's standing there, and he can you know that feeling when you're like, you can feel the people drinking and how good they're having and how much you want to go in there? And for some reason, that man decides to go make a phone call instead and reach out to find another alcoholic. If he had not made that decision, I just got goosebumps. If he had not made that decision, none of us would be standing here, me standing here, you guys sitting there. None of us. We'd all, I mean, who knows? I'd be in the insane asylum, I'm pretty sure, or dead. And people need to know that. People coming in here, they need to know how, I feel kind of preachy, but that's all right. They need to know how this thing started and respect it. You know, people coming in here, it's up to us to teach what this program, how it started, and to keep teaching it, to keep teaching the literature. And that, you know, I have my opinion, but this is Alcoholics Anonymous right here. Not what I'm saying. I'm sharing my experience, strength, and hope with you, and we're a fellowship, but this right here is the program. The 12 and 12, I kind of use that to expand, you know, some of the steps. It's not really very clear. Like 6 and 7, much easier to read it in the 12 and 12, in my opinion. But I feel really passionately about protecting this, because it's the only way that my kids are going to have a good life. It's the only way that I'm going to stay sober. There is no other option for me, and I am pretty sure it's the same for you. Like, this is it. There's no other, like, I can't get fixed in therapy. I can't get fixed in any other way. There's no medicine for me. This is it. Like, and I protect it. I've fallen in love, and I hope that that happens for you. I hope that you fall in love with Alcoholics Anonymous and make it the most important thing. It doesn't always mean, I mean, I used to go to 7 meetings a week and just, like, have all kinds of crazy commitments, but my life has changed. And when I had my kids, I kind of freaked out because I used to get on my knees and pray every morning, and I'd have this like routine that I'd been doing for many, many years. And when I had my kids, like, it was like all hell broke loose. Like, I couldn't get like my head around what was happening. And I called my sponsor and I'm like, I'm afraid. I'm afraid because I'd had this, you know, pattern, and it had kept me sober, and it's different now. And she said to me, it doesn't matter what the outside looks like. It's what's going on inside. Are you connected to God? Are you talking to other alcoholics? And I was. And am I still committed? And yes, I was. So to people whose lives shift and change, it can look different. In the big book, it talks about, like, you could be sober in Antarctica, you know? I mean, things just look different sometimes. And so after my kids got older, I was able to get back to more meetings, and I just always kept that. Like, when I can go, I'll go back. And that's just what I've been taught, is that you just keep going to meetings. No matter how much sobriety you have, just don't stop coming here, no matter what. So cute. Love that little voice. So let's see. So I met this guy in AA. I thought we were going to just have this, like, great AA marriage, and that's just not what happened. I tried really, really hard. I went to therapy. I went back to Al-Anon. I kept my side of the street clean. I did the best that I could. And then it just, you know, it didn't work. So I had to handle that with as much grace and dignity as possible, but it was hard, you know. It's hard when people are talking about you and you want to defend yourself, but you can't, you know, because that's not the spiritual thing to do. We don't do that. Or we do. I mean, do whatever. I mean, we're going to do it. You're going to do whatever you're going to do, and I'm going to do whatever we're going to do, and hopefully we got out of here alive. You know what I mean? Like, hopefully we all stay sober. But the only guarantee, like I was just about to say, there's no guarantee, but I actually don't believe that. The guarantee of us staying sober is right here. Like, it tells us that if we do everything that's asked of us, and if we work the steps, and if you have a spiritual awakening, and if you work with others, and you continue to expand your spiritual life, that you are guaranteed to stay sober. So that is the good news. Like, you can't, there is, no matter what, and I don't like to even think of, like, the worst thing that could happen to me, like, because that would be, like, something happening to my kids. 10 minutes, thank you. I'm guaranteed to stay sober through anything. I don't know if I would want to, but I've seen people who have killed other people, and they're sober, and they share their story, and that happened to another person, so they're not so alone. I mean, truly, I've seen miracles in the past 20-plus years, just, like, serious miracles. People, So speaking here, I'm a little sweaty. I'm still a little nervous, but I feel kind of at home with you guys because you're kind of my peers. But when I was 4 years sober, if you guys know Tim from Santa Barbara, Tim W., he may still do it, but he used to take a panel to the correctional facility just up past San Luis Obispo. For some reason, he thought it was a good idea for me at 4 years sober, 24 years old, to go and speak there. So I did that. So you guys are like nothing. I spoke in front of a room full of people and men in prison in Orange, like serious, scary people who have done scary things. And I was like, these people are never, they don't care. I mean, I felt so dumb sharing my story. And I have to tell you, afterwards I stood and almost all of them came up to me and they all shook my hand. And many of them told me how they could relate to my story, the feelings in my story. Not so much the drinking, not so much like the exact things that happened, but the feeling of ease and comfort that came at once from the first drink, drinking for oblivion, not knowing what you were going to do once you drank, the blackout, the Jekyll and Hyde. Like, that's what we all share. You know, our outsides are different and the circumstance is different, but that's how we all drink. That's what makes us alcoholics. The spiritual malady, the fact that I feel and have always felt like I have a hole in my soul and I've tried to fill it with anything and everything. Believe me, just anything to stop that pain, anything to make me feel better. And nothing for me has worked other than a higher power. Nothing. And I hated God when I came here. I prayed to God to bring my mom home sober. God didn't deliver. F God, right? But I got here and I learned the only thing that's ever going to keep me sober is a higher power. So just a little, to wrap things up here, whenever I go into a situation where there's drinking, I always pray. I pray, please God, remove the insanity. Please keep me safe. Keep me safe, sane, and sober, because I still love the smell of red wine. Oh, I love it. Like, it's just so beautiful. It's just, like, it's so seductive, right? And I look at people and how they can drink with impunity. And every once in a while, I'm like, yeah. But then, luckily, I've been restored to sanity, and I'm like, no, that would not be me. It just wouldn't. I'm not classy, and it says in the big book that women go down the tubes faster than men, and that was definitely my story. Sober at 20, there is no class left in my drinking, if there ever was. I don't think there ever was. I mean, people would be embarrassed by me, and I would hear stories, and I'm a kind person. Oh, really quick, Larry, I love what you said about what you're teaching your kids. I'm teaching my kids by example how to be kind, how to not hurt people's feelings, how to not take things so seriously. I mean, everything that my kids are because of you guys. The people that they're becoming to give back to the world, it's because of what I learned here. You know, stick out your hand, say hello to people, you know, give back. Just all the principles that I've learned here, they're getting by osmosis, and hopefully they won't be alcoholics. I hope not, but if they are, you know, there's a place to come. I try not to think about that, because then my head will just spin out worrying about my kids. I already worry about them too much. Anyways, I'm going to wrap it up. Because somebody said there's nothing worse than a speaker who goes too long. I think that was you, Larry. I am forever grateful to Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm lucky that my mom got sober again, and she's sober. We have an amazing relationship because I worked the steps. I worked my butt off in Al-Anon, so there's no resentment at all. There's just forgiveness and a great, like, amazing relationship there. I have a really great relationship today where I am using the tools that I have been shown here. Like, I'm honest, I know boundaries, I'm kind, and it's like, who is this person? It's so crazy. But I get to be transformed here, and I get to be transformed, you know, in all different ways. And that's what I can tell you, is that anything that you want, anything that you dream, you can have here. It may not be exactly what it is that you like specifically, but in my life, God always knows better. That for I can dream it, but God's got a much better plan, is what I'm trying to say. So work the steps, go to meetings, get a sponsor, tell the truth, reach out to newcomers, come to meetings. Did I say that? Do the steps. Just, you know, do what people, I basically do everything that I was taught in my first year. I just, like, keep repeating it for the, over the last 20-something years. I just keep doing it over and over. I never know how to end this stuff. So thanks for having me. Thanks for my sobriety, and God bless.
Let's have another round of applause for Trish. Okay, we'd like to thank all the folks who have commitments to make this meeting possible. If you have a commitment, please stand so that we can thank you. And could I have a show of hands of a few people that would please help clean up afterwards? All right, great. Thank you, guys. We got lots of coffee cups to wash and fun stuff like that. So thanks for attending, and hope to see you again next month. Next month I have Karen Lehman, and she's a good speaker. And after that, the following month, we have Noah Daniels from the Dogs, and that's going to be another good speaker too. So keep coming back. And Cody, would you pray us out?